Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of the Proper Class Podcast. I'm Hannah Chiswick.
And I'm Laura Checkley.
And we are, of course, here to celebrate all things working class, because if we don't, who the bloody hell will, eh? As always...
Hold on. What are you doing there, Machika?
What?
Have you just taken it upon yourself to steal my catchphrase?
Well, it's not really a catchphrase, is it?
So... Well, it's very much a catchphrase and it's actually catching on. That's why people call it a catchphrase, Hannah.
Absolutely nobody calls
that
a catchphrase.
No, listen. I know I said last week, right, that I didn't want to do the catchphrase anymore. It didn't actually mean that you should now go ahead and do it.
This is a bit awkward. Well, Michelle called me actually yesterday just to have a little chat and discuss the future of the catchphrase and what she was...
Oh, no, hold on. You and our producer, Michelle, had a little natter, did you, without me? Excuse me whilst I remove that blunt old Nike from my back.
Big old Nike.
Big Nike trainer in my back. That's how I feel.
It's not a big deal. You said you didn't want to do any more, so I just thought I'd give it a go.
All right, okay, fine. Good luck with it. And, watch the complaints come rolling in. Go on, carry on.
Wow. Each week we sit down with a working class hero and discuss just how they got to where they are today. So without further ado, who are we celebrating this week, Law?
Well, it's fair to say that this week's guest and I go way back when, to a time when I had just one chin and he had hair. I mean, I lie, I don't think I've ever known him to have had hair, or for me to have ever had one chin for that matter, but you get the picture. I actually can't quite believe we've managed to pin this week's guest down, because he is quite literally, without a doubt, the busiest man in showbiz. Not only an award-winning comedian, but this week's guest is also a presenter, writer, podcaster and author to boot.
In 2005, at just 22 years of age, he burst onto the comedy scene winning So You Think You're Funny, Best Newcomer Award. And in the same year, he also won the BBC's New Comedy Award. So not a bad start.
Not too shabby.
After that, there really was no looking back. With sellout shows in Edinburgh and London, and he was quickly whisked off and put on the road, supporting the likes of Sarah Millican, Michael McIntyre and Ramesh Ranganathan, taking him all over the world. So it's hardly surprising that soon after, he was headlining his own sellout tours and becoming a comedy heavyweight in his own right.
In 2018 and 19, his sellout tour, Absolutely, was so successful it extended a number of times, culminating in an unforgettable sold-out run at the London Palladium, which was filmed and broadcast on Channel 4.
Not only a star on stage, but this week's guest has been making a real splash on our screens too, appearing in shows such as Live at the Apollo, A League of Their Own, 8 out of 10 Cats, The Last Leg, Would I Lie to You, Mock the Week, The Jonathan Ross Show.
Jonathan?
That's how Jonathan would say it, which is why I thought I'd say it like that. The Jonathan Ross Show, and even put in a shift for the Royal Variety. Not content with all that, he's also had his own series on Radio 4, got a hugely popular podcast, and has just penned his critically acclaimed Sunday Times best-selling memoir. Oh, blimey, I'm running out of breath there. No Shame.
You need to put your teeth back in, babe. But no doubt you'll probably know this week's guest best for hosting shows such as The Apprentice, You're Fired, Bake Off, The Professionals, Bake Off, Extra Slice, all the bake-offs, Quizness and Complaints Welcome, to name but a few. Quite simply, the dude is a huge success and quickly becoming a national treasure. And believe me when I say it couldn't have happened to a lovely, more deserving man. Folks, with a wit as sharp as his two-piece whistles and my mum's favourite, it's the hilarious Tom Allen!
Oh, that's too generous an introduction. Too generous.
Why is it too generous? But it's all the things you've done.
Oh, well, I suppose, but you know.
How does it feel hearing it all back? We always ask our guests how it feels to hear all that stuff back.
It's very nice. It's very nice. I like the only, you said Soon was put on to supporting people on the road. It took me about 10 years to get booked on any of those support gigs.
Did it really?
Yeah, I've been a stand-up for 17 years now. So it took me about 12 years before I got remotely confident. So
I remember seeing you for the first time on the circuit when we were all like playing to an audience of 30 in a smelly old pub. And I remember thinking, like, why has he not already got his chat show? I've thought that for so many years. Oh. Like honestly, like, and it's so amazing to see you doing so well. Are you exhausted?
I'm quite tired sometimes, but I like being busy. I like doing stuff. I think sometimes it feels like I'm driving with the brakes on. I don't know quite why that is. I think if I'm sort of worried about stuff, then it sort of gets in the way. And if I think too much, then that gets in the way. So it's better to be, just be in the moment, isn't it? Just go with it, just do stuff. And I love doing stuff and love being busy. So yeah, I feel very grateful. And because I had that sort of 12, 13 years of just doing clubs up and down the country and just trying to work out who I was and trying to be good and trying to sort of like claw my way in, and not getting anywhere and living with my mum and dad, I'm very grateful for any opportunity I have or any gig I get to do now. Somebody I was working with last year was like, oh my God, you know, it took me 5 years to get to this point. And I was like, jeez. 5 bloody years, that all?
Right, sit down.
Sit down,
mate. Let me
tell
you about myself.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But that's very pompous of me to say, so I shouldn't say it.
Not really. Not at all. I mean, do you feel like you've earned it though? Like there's a little bit of you that goes, yeah, do you know what? I've worked fucking hard for this.
No, I think as soon as I think like that, it'll all disappear, won't it? I always feel like I'm on the brink of it all disappearing tomorrow. So in fact, if anything, I'm just terribly stressed and trying not to mess it all up, knowing that I had that period of working towards it, if that makes sense. Basically, yeah, totally. I like to not be happy. That's basically what I've realised is my default. And heaven forfend, I should be happy. But no, it's very generous. No, that's churlish of me to even question it. Thank you for such a lovely, warm introduction. And I remember doing your lovely gig in the downstairs of an Italian restaurant, which people didn't realise had
a... Yeah, big shout out to Coa.
Yeah, big shout out to Coa. Yeah. I think we still owe them a bill, don't we?
We start every week by asking our guests if they could take us back to a place that reminds them of their working class past.
Yes.
Where would they take us? So where are you going to take us to this week?
Well, there's lots of options. And I realise that I come on this and people might be like, what's he talking about working classness? Because I've basically been cursed with this posh voice, which my parents never had a particularly posh voice. They're from London. My dad was, for most of his working life, a coach driver. And my mum has had various jobs. She's retired now, but she worked in the Army and Navy in Bromley High Street on ladies' fashions. And they're both, my mum's from Sydenham in southeast London and my dad is from Penge. Well, Annerley.
I live now.
And you live now because you're part of that gentrification, of course, Laura. That's the problem, isn't it? Coming
it's
in.
It's got a lovely park.
I bet it has. Yes, of course. You people, you love the park, don't you? What do you do?
For me,
do a bit of yoga there, do you? Probably.
I do a bit of hot yoga, not
yes,
going to lie.
Of course
and
you
I've
do.
Got a toy poodle, so.
Yes, you've ruined
who
it.
Who am I? Who
you've ruined
even
the
am
whole
I?
Area. Exactly. Actually, my dad would say, I'm not from Penge. I'm from Annerley, which he thought sounded posher, but of course sounds much worse. Sounds like
Penge is much posher than Annerley.
Ah, well, that was never the case, I think, for Dad. But yeah, so I realize I've always had this posh voice, and people will always be like, why'd you talk like that? Why? Why'd you talk like that? Why? And I don't know if it's like a gay thing. I'd lay everything at the feet of that. But sure. I think it's a gay thing. They're like, oh, I'm just going to have a different voice. And people are like, but why? Why? And ever since I was at primary school, as soon as I started primary school, why have you got that posh voice? I went to secondary school. Why? Why are you posh? Why are you posh? You're looking down on me. Like, and of course I wasn't. Well, I was. But
were any of your relatives sort of posh
no,
or well-spoken?
Nobody. Irish. They're just Irish. Or London on my dad's side. But my dad's family, we didn't know really. So it's just my dad. And my mum's side, which is we only really spent time with my nan, who was Irish. So that's the only, those are my only influences. So nobody was posh. So
did
I just affected
it. Do you remember making the decision and thinking,
Just came out of nowhere.
I love
absolutely
it so
no
much.
Explanation for it. But people have always asked me why, and I don't know why it is. I think it's the same way that like maybe... I don't know, like Alan Carr has got quite a distinctive voice. Mm. I don't know. You know, various people have got quite distinctive voices. And I suppose it's that, really. But so anyway, I just say that to qualify myself. Otherwise, people will be like, what's he think he is? What, coming on here, talking about class?
And yeah, but you know what? Voice. Until I saw your stand-up, and I think there was a set where you talk about, is it your mum or someone's mum at the school gates? And then you spoke about your background. And I was like, oh, my God, I didn't realised Tom was really working class. I just assumed an assumption just because you speak well. And why can't we speak well if we're working class? Why not?
Well, indeed. And of course, there's a misunderstanding a lot of the time. I think people assume that posh people, old money people, are much more prone to snobbery and to sort of looking down their noses at people. But in my experience, the reverse has been true. And that anybody working class has been the biggest snob I've ever met. Like, I used to work with somebody. I used to talk like that all the time. And we used to have people coming in. It was a golf club restaurant. And I used to work there with her. And she'd be like, oh, yeah, well. And I'd say, oh, they were nice customers, weren't they? And she's like, oh, yeah, they're all right. A bit core blimey. And I thought, like, so interesting, isn't it? That there's an assumption in, like, Downton Abbey that it's, like, posh people looking down their nose. In my experience, it's never been posh people looking down their nose. It's always been other working class people go, well, I'll look at, you know, my mum.
Who do they think they are?
Who do they think they are? They're full of them, full of their bleeding selves. Yeah. Don't you can't get too up and you can't get too down. Like,
no.
Or like my dad would say, if my dad burnt the toast, he'd put it on the front garden so the birds could have it. And my mum would be like, that's typical Penge. That is typical Penge. Put that out there. That's disgusting. People come around. What do they think of us? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's always that. And then you'd get like a more middle-class family would move in who'd leave their bins out for too long. And my mum would be like, oh, it's disgusting. Look, them leaving their bins out. What do they think this is? It's not, you don't leave your bins on the street around here. Put your bins away.
Yeah, I think that comes from a place that when you are working class, I know my mum's always like, the house is pristine.
Everything's pristine.
Because it's to go, that's our to idea avoid judgment. Of what, yeah, to avoid judgment and what our idea of what money is and what, you know.
And I think it's about controlling the things you can control, I think. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like, well, you don't have to have money. You don't have to have, traditionally, working people couldn't access money or status, but you could control how clean your front step was, or you could control what your kids looked like going to school. Like, my dad would always polish our shoes before we went to school. It was unthinkable that we'd go to school without polished shoes.
Yeah.
I think subverting the idea that people would look down on us and go, oh, look, them scruffy kids. Look at them poor kids, you know, that sort of thing. And I think
there are so many, like, dual standards like that, though, aren't there? And you can understand why people become like that, because I just think there are some things that people with money or status, and whichever way you look at it, class, afforded far more space and not judged in the same way. So, like, you know, I often think that, like, you go to really posh events and you'll see the person with the most money walking in like, dirty trainers and because they're literally not I bet people look at me and think this. They couldn't give two shits.
I saw a posh actress with some Ugg boots at a premiere once, and I honestly, the first thing I did is got on the phone to my mum and went, you'll never guess. She had Ugg boots on, mum. She had Ugg boots on.
Because she's got the self-assurance, the lack of judgment to think no one's going to look at me and think I've got nothing. They know I haven't. She just hasn't thought about that. Whereas if you're sending your kids to school on already waiting for people to criticise your parenting, I think people are like, the least we can do is iron this uniform with an inch of its life.
Yeah. And it's the posh kids who will be the badly behaved kids who run around. Yeah. But my mum was always like, I was so proud of you. You behaved so well. Oh, you behaved so nicely in front of it. That was always like very important to my mum that we always were polite.
Represented
well. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
And I was, I realise I'm subverting what I've just said, but I did go to the Chelsea Flower Show on Monday. All right, okay. I've only been twice, so it's not like a regular haunt of mine.
But is it lovely, though? It looks lovely.
It's absolutely fabulous, actually, Laura. You know, it's very... everybody's in a good mood, because you can't be an angry gardener, can you? You know what I mean? You never did about like these bloody, got to dig up these bloody vegetables, take down the bloody Chelsea Flower Show. You can't be like that.
I'm that person now that when I pop up to Crystal Palace Village, I go and I get myself a little bunch of flowers every week.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, nice treat. My mum always says...
But that's quite a middle class thing to do, I think, to buy a bunch of flowers every week.
No, my mum would always say, I don't smoke, so I spend that money on flowers.
Elton John, he loves to spend up on a flower, doesn't he?
Well, my dad always had the saying, he said... Well, and talking about class, he always said, next to Elton John, I'm a pauper, but next to a pauper, I'm Elton John. Which I thought was a funny way of, like, my dad couldn't be more different to Elton John.
Has he got glasses at least, or?
My dad did wear glasses, yes, but not in the same style as Elton. Never had those kind of like spindles coming off them or like lights or anything.
Pinch. No,
walking around Penge, exactly.
So where are you going to take us back to then? I don't think we got to that, did we? Where would
I'm
you
sorry,
take us?
I went off on this big... Well, again, in the complexity of it, I have two options and you can choose. Right. One is... maybe an obvious choice, but it's at the Anglesey Arms pub in Bromley, where my dad would take me when I was about 4 or 5 years old. my dad would take, on a Sunday, he hadn't gone to church beforehand, but when I was his eldest, and he thought it would be a good thing for me to be taken to church. So we went to church on a Sunday morning, and then afterwards we'd pop into the Anglesey Arms, which he loved the pub. So it's a real contrast, really, when you think about
bit
it.
Bit of yin and yang both,
wine yeah. available in both. And so we'd go to the Anglesey Arms pub, and it was just, he loved that sense of, he said it was a public house. When people didn't have space to entertain, you'd go to the public house.
Yeah,
because then you could publicly, that's where you would socialise. You wouldn't have a party in your house because your house would be too small. Or, you know, you wouldn't, it just wouldn't be set up for that. It would be like a, you know, you might have a parlour if you were lucky, but likely the hood is you had a back room, which was a kitchen, come everything. So you go down to the pub to celebrate or socialise or talk. And he loved that idea.
Was it like an old boozer, like old Pipe and Slipper kind of place?
It was, but again, it wasn't scruffy. It was very, as you see, like those pubs around London, those old Victorian pubs and stuff.
Beautiful.
And everywhere, actually, not just London, but everywhere. They've got that beautiful beveled glass, beautiful brass work, beautiful shining bars. Again, because there's that sense of pride in those spaces, even though they were places where, you know, and always that desperation to be like a reputable establishment, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then on a Sunday, they put out like Cockles and Welks on the bar.
Oh, lovely.
Sort of like that kind of Cockney tradition, that sort of Cockney tapas.
Of
Cockles and Welks and maybe some crisps, maybe a few mini.
We used to have around my nan's right up until my teens. We would horse and cart would come around with the shellfish, and we'd we'd get winkles. Winkles are hard work, weren't they? And you'd get like a little pin to pick them out with, and cockles. Yeah. I loved cockles and loads of vinegar on, and crab sticks. They were always a favourite, weren't they?
Still love a
crab stick.
You still go a crab stick, don't you?
Oh, yeah, lovely. A pack of crab sticks. Yeah.
Lovely treat, isn't it? Yeah.
And they're not a nice thing to eat on a train, but they are nice.
Oh, God, no.
With a homemade mayonnaise. you can elevate them, you know? No, they're lovely. Sometimes there'll be jelly deals, but I don't really remember them very well. And they're not something I've ever had.
Thank you for a jelly deal.
No, I'd not thank you for a jelly deal. Ooh. So maybe the Anglesey Arms. My mum never liked the pub. Oh, I don't like going to the pub. All smoke and everything gets in your air. And like that. So mum didn't like that. Mum doesn't really talk as extremely as that. She can't.
She'll be furious.
But then the other place I was going to say is, which I think taps into the nuanced surrounding class, which I'm always fascinated by. One of the most fabulous places that opened for us was the Glades Shopping Centre in Bromley.
That's
your way, wasn't it?
Yes, I spent much of my teenage years in the Glades, Bromley.
Same. Where did you grow up, Hannah?
So I grew up in, I grew up in Greenwich, which now sounds terribly posh, doesn't it? But it was not.
I know.
And I went to school in Kidbrook.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, the big outing was like, you know, once we were allowed to go on our own, we'd go to the Glades.
Same.
Yeah.
It was a real hotbed of teenagers. Like either beating each other up or getting off with each other. Neither of which I partook in because I was too busy looking around Marks and Spencer's or maybe in the body shop buying some bath pearls. But still, it was exciting. And I think the fact of the matter was the Glades was a very fancy place because it felt very glamorous and felt very modern to go to an indoor shopping precinct.
Yeah, that was quite a sort of new thing, wasn't it, with us growing up, those sort of shopping centres. There wasn't, like, you'd get, like, you started getting them sort of in the 90s, was it? They were around early,
but that particular one with, like, a little bit more, like, you know, my local one was Lewisham's shopping centre.
Oh, yes.
And that's still pretty much as it was. I'm not, like, honestly, the same shops for, like, the last 40 years.
Yes.
But to get to the Glades, you'd have to take two buses, but it was worth it because it was thought of as, like...
Mine was
it just had a bit more high fashion. I mean, when I say high fashion, it was Dotty P's.
Debenhams, yeah.
It was Debenhams.
A lovely Debenhams. Yeah.
There was a Debenhams, actually.
Lovely Debenhams. Oh. There was sometimes we'd get on the 119 and go over to the Whitgift in Croydon, and that really did feel like a true metropolis. You could see it as you went over the hill by Kelsey Park.
I sometimes go up to Croydon because it's just quicker for me to get to sometimes. But the Whitgift is
going strong. No?
Well, so it's still going, but a lot of stuff's boarded up, and pretty sad to see. Yeah,
because like
back when I was like when I used to go to Brit School, which was around the corner. Oh, you were
at the Brit
Croydon.
School? I didn't know.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Did you go Brit?
Yeah. A lot of high streets like that, and now like regional high streets, they're buggered, particularly after COVID and everything, you know.
Yeah, well, I think it represents, and I remember when Lakeside opened, and my nan would love going to Lakeside
that was a metropolis,
and that was a new Bentalls, it was huge, everything was massive. that felt so thrilling. Because I think as well, again, people go, a shopping centre, that's not a traditionally working class place, is it? But I remember talking to like a friend of mine who's like quite old school lefty, and she's like, oh, it's just, you know, commercialisation. It's just like the commercial, like, just that's all people became, is like commodities, and it all came up just commercialisation. And I was like, well, yes, I suppose it did. But at the same time, it was very exciting for my family because it was a glamorous place to go and buy stuff.
But also, like, I always think of it as a very working class place because actually you can have a big old day out and spend no money. That's such a weird thing. Like, me and you will still do that. Should we go, oh, we're going to go and have a walk around the shops?
Yeah, just have a walk around the shops.
Just a walk around, a look. You don't have to buy anything. I love a lot of planning for Christmas. I love, like, for working class people going, like, taking kids from quite early in the year and going, like, let's make a list and we'll plan and we'll have a look and see what everyone wants. And it's an outing, and then you can get something very cheap to eat in a food court.
Yeah.
And that's a whole day's...
Lovely.
There might be a little playground, might there? Like a little thing for a kid to run about in.
Yeah.
And I still love doing that.
We weren't the sort of family that would go out and always get something. You know, some kids would be like, my nan bought me something. Like, we'd never have that.
I was going to just ask you about sort of school and how was school for you? Were you academic? Did you enjoy it?
Well, I found primary school, actually, I didn't enjoy at all. Hated primary school.
Oh, really?
Bullied at primary
school. The other way around.
It is usually the other way around. Hated primary school, was bullied mainly by the girls who I wanted to be friends with, and they were horrible to me. But then I went to secondary school, and I was still bullied at secondary school as well. I went to Scotts Park Primary School, and then I went to Cooper's Comprehensive School in Bromley. And that was terrifying, and I was bullied there. But also, I liked school, and I realised that it was a place I could do whatever, I could explore different things, and I could be anonymous, and I could go into different, I could go and do music, or I could go and do drama. And it meant I was busy at break time, so it didn't matter that I didn't really have many friends. And I know that sounds sad, but I'm just putting it out there because maybe there's somebody else who's the same. So that's why I say I don't invite.
Surviving
it, exactly. And I was actually very good at school. You know, it's always that thing of comedians being like, oh no, I was shit at school. All my teachers hated me, and I had to be funny to survive, and I had to be funny to distract the bullies. And I was like, no, I wasn't any of those things. I was just bullied. And then I was good at school, and I really liked school. I really liked studying, and I really liked, and I did very well. And I was head boy, and I did very well in my A-levels. So, you know, there you go.
I admire your courage at that age to, like, because I went to a really posh dance school alongside going to quite a rough school, comprehensive.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd go to my dance school and I'd speak, you know, really posh, or I'd try to, I was like, a bit more like that. But and then I'd go to my school and I'd be all like, you know, all right. And I just was like leading like a double life because I didn't have the balls to be my authentic self. Oh, yeah. And if I was in your shoes, I definitely would have tried to, like, I don't know, do a wider accent, not be so posh and stand out. Like, I admire that you're like, no, this is me, and I'm going to float off to my music class, and I'm going to, like, a lot of kids aren't brave enough to do that.
Well, I just sort of felt like every time I tried to be, like, fitting in or anything, I just felt like a square peg in a round hole. And so I just thought, you know what, I am an eccentric posh kid who's from a very ordinary family, who's at a very ordinary school, and this is just the way I am. And I think there's lots of people like that who stifle it because they're scared. And I just think that's such a sadness because it's stifling their creativity or whatever. Because I just sort of felt like I like wearing, it was sort of when I got to about year 9 and stuff, and I was like, you know what, to hell with it. I didn't come out, too scared to come out, couldn't dream of coming out, but was like, I can't do that. It's unthinkable to come out, actually, in my school. That's what thing I sort of say to people. Wasn't it? Did you think that, Laura?
Oh, it was never an option. When I got to drama school, really, there were no lesbians. I didn't know any lesbians. I certainly weren't coming out. I think the first time I really laid eyes on a lesbian was Brookside, that lesbian storyline.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, those storylines were so powerful because they were the only role models we had, like Queer as Folk.
Yeah.
Watching it going, oh my God, I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, I always had this sense of sort of growing up that when you grew up around a bit more culture, and I always thought, oh, middle class people are cultured and da-da-da. I judged and thought that working class people wouldn't really understand me. My family wouldn't get me. They don't know any gay people. Constantly grew up with, you know, jokes, inappropriate jokes about gay people. So I was like, it was never an option. Like,
right. Yeah.
Never.
It wasn't like, yeah, exactly like that. And I always feel like I want to explain that to people because it wasn't like, wow, it's so brave, or like, I don't know, it's not, sometimes people like simplify those narratives and it always drives me up the wall because I'm like, no, it wasn't like that. You just don't, it was just like, it wasn't like I was battling it, really. I suppose I was, in a way. But for most of my youth, I just locked it away in a box and buried it.
Yeah.
And buried it and forgot about it. And just tried to blend in as much as possible, really. And so, yeah, so I just, after a while, I just sort of thought, I'm going to wear whatever I want. I'm going to be a Noel Coward fan, and even though I'm 14.
How did you come across things like that, like Noel Coward, like in a working class home?
Well, it's funny because I loved Elton John. I loved piano music. I loved his extravagance. I loved him from really early on. I was obsessed with him as a teenager. He was like, everybody else was obsessed with like Oasis and Blur. And I was like, Elton John. And that wasn't cool. It wasn't cool to be different then. No. It wasn't cool to be eccentric. It wasn't cool to be like, to like someone else. And he was just outlandish, I suppose. That's what I liked about Elton John. And I liked the piano. I did piano lessons. And then one of my music teachers said, you know, you might like Noel Coward. And so I took a book out of Bromley Central Library. Thank God for libraries.
I know.
And the Noel Coward songbook and a CD, a lovely musical called Noel and Gertie.
I know it well.
And do you really, Hannah?
I really do.
It's a lovely recording they did. Oh, well, it's a good recording of it. It's just all the songs, but they were more modern, because otherwise all the recordings of Noel Coward songs are from like the 1930s. And they were like, people singing like,
Noel Coward is famous. I've been to a fabulous party. That's a Noel Coward, isn't it? Yes.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But then, of course, he had some more sad ones, which obviously I gravitated towards. Matterlow, I'll See You Again, The Party's Over Now, all the very maudlin ones.
All The Party's Over, that's a beauty.
Do you like that one?
Oh my God, I love it.
That one.
And so you were how old when you were listening to Noel Coward?
14, 15.
Wow.
And my parents were like, oh yes, very into, like very kind of like supportive of it. And like,
that's amazing.
They kind of liked it, yeah.
And so was the idea born there that you wanted to perform in some way? Or
I think I always knew I wanted to perform from sort of like late primary school, I suppose. I liked being eccentric and I liked being on stage. I liked doing little shows and I liked being different. I auditioned to be in the year four production of Joseph, the school's version. Didn't get the part of Joseph. That went to a boy called Luke, I think. But I knew there was another part going for the Pharaoh. And so I asked them if I could audition for that. I got the part of the Pharaoh.
Amazing.
I enjoyed it very much, yeah.
And sure, I'm way more interesting than Joseph, sorry.
Well, I realised that, of course, I was a character actor.
Yeah.
At the age of 8, yeah.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Thank you.
What happens after high school then? Did you go on to university or?
No, tried to go to university. I liked studying and they said, why didn't you do an interview for Cambridge? And so I sent off the forms. They invited me for an interview and I just stuffed it up because I didn't know how to do those sort of interviews and always carry a bit of a chip on my shoulder about it.
Yeah.
I think it's a massive big deal that actually one of our previous guests was talking about that. Like, that is so, I'm a theatre director and some of the best actors I know are just absolutely abysmal at an audition.
Oh,
it's
right.
A whole other skill,
yeah.
Like being good at an audition, to being a good actor. The two things are related, but they are not the same. Mm-hmm. And it's a similar thing. There are just people who are just absolutely brilliant brains, but are not good. And if you've never been in that environment, if you have a private education, it's built into your timetable from the minute you get there that's where you belong, that's who you are, that they
and
practice
presumably if
with
you're going
you
up for Oxford, they probably train you.
They
tutor you, of course, within an inch of your life.
You've been tutored from the minute you started school for your, you know, to get into your school. And so you turn up with a level of just practice that you don't know what the rules are.
No, absolutely not. I thought you just had to be polite and just show that you were polite. And the sort of the essays I'd sent in, I thought would speak for themselves in a way, because my teachers said they were very good. and the sort of work I'd sent in. Well, I'd like to think so. But of course, I was just like wittering on about Noel Coward and about how I liked the arts and how I liked, and they were like, we're talking to you about, they didn't say this, but they gave me some feedback afterwards in written form and said I had a tendency to jump in too quickly with an answer rather than thinking it through.
Wow.
And I remember thinking years after, actually, that was, again, a symptom of my upbringing, because it was like, well, be a nice, polite young person. If somebody asks you a question, don't sit there and think about what you're going to say. You answer and say, oh, thank you very much. Yes, I'd like to. Well, I like this and I like that. And I'm very happy. It was very sort of, and looking back, I must have been so naive about it. But, and forgive me, I suppose I do have a bit of a chip on my shoulder about it. But in my mind, I was like, you've got to do the degree that leads to something that you want to do.
Yeah.
It's not just sort of a thing that you do just to nurture your brain. So I didn't go to university at all. And then I thought, well, I want to be on the stage. I should be an actor. Why didn't I go to drama school and audition for drama school? And oh, my God, they effing hated me.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. The only ones who liked ones who were nice was Rada.
Wow.
So I've got nothing bad to say about Rada. They were so lovely. It was only the last round I got to.
And why do you think they hated you? What did you feel like they...
Oh, can you imagine, Han? These drama schools either want, right? If you think about it, sorry if anybody works in a drama school now, but back, what we're talking, 20 years ago, they are posh people wearing scarves. They want either another posh person they can put into all those leading roles and all those period dramas, or they want somebody who fits their idea of what a working class kid is, which is not someone with a side parting swept back, dressed as Noel Coward, coming in to do an Alan Bennett monologue.
Yeah, yeah. I do think drama schools have changed now.
Yes, I'm sure.
Very recent change.
Very recent change, though, in the last sort of few years, really, thank God. But back when, you know, like when I was auditioning, which was, you know, a good 20 odd years ago, I went into an audition for a drama school. I won't name them. I pulled a lot of faces, wanted to be funny. And one of the teachers said to me, you don't seem like you should do comedy. Like it feels like you're in the wrong body. And what they were suggesting was that to be funny, I needed to put on weight. Because that's how they viewed funny women. Then you can only be funny if you're big.
Isn't it extraordinary?
And that's terrible, exactly what happened to me when I first auditioned. They didn't know what loads of drama schools didn't know what to do with me because I was like a rake, blonde hair and, you know, lovely tan. You know, I was just wandering in really leggy pulling loads of faces, being a right goofball. But luckily I found a drama school that saw that in me.
Where did you go, Laura? Where did you go?
I went to Mountview.
So you didn't even know about that one?
Yeah, and they were brilliant. They never knocked your accent out of you. They encouraged you to keep it. I think, you know, certainly 20 odd years ago, they were really ahead of their time.
I think, though, it's only now that, like, I've been, like, directing drama schools and as well as, you know, obviously, like, alongside doing my professional directing as well, like, all my career to, you know, make ends meet. And I love it as well. I find it important. Also, I like being a sort of mouthy woman in that environment and going against all those things you were saying and finding those, like, odd kids who do walk in and do a monologue for a 40-year-old man.
We would love that, wouldn't we? If we were auditioning and a kid like you'd come in and said, I love Noel Coward,
I would have loved it.
Yeah, beside myself.
But when I started, it was all like... And I was always the one who was saying, no, it's not true. But it was like, you mustn't let anyone know your sexuality.
Absolutely.
Never, ever, ever do a monologue that suggests you're gay. Let the
panel
be totally but make sure the panel have no idea and never have any tattoos. You mustn't speak in a regional accent. Don't have any piercings. Mm. Whatever you do, I mean, just so much. Like,
don't be interesting, basically.
Make yourself as blank a canvas as you can be.
Yeah.
And it's just not like that, thank God, anymore.
That's good.
Or I think where it is, it's really dying out. And thank God for that, because, of course, make as an actor, you need to be adaptable, but you also need to be your authentic self. No one can go through their life not living as themselves. That's just not...
No, now more than ever.
Well, and also, I think, which is so exciting, I think, because now the access to making the work is a bit more... straightforward, you know, as in, like, you can make a film and put it on Instagram, or you can, do you know what I mean? Things like, I know it's not as simple as that, but there's a bit more sort of communication between people online and a sort of validation, I imagine, I hope, for young people, because so then you can go and do your own stuff and make stuff and feel like that's enough. Whereas it felt for me like drama school was the only way you would ever find a way into being, because that's interesting you say that, Laura, about like the teacher saying you want to be a comedian. There was no like training for comedians. All there was like you go and become an actor, and that was it. That was all as far as I understood. I didn't understand anything else, so I had no idea about the path, that what the path was. It's not even just getting a foot in the door. Where the door was,
absolutely,
was so removed from me. And that's why I think it's still probably the same a lot of the time. Young people, hugely talented, huge kind of creative instinct, just have denied it because they just go, I don't know how to do it. But if your parents are in the arts, then it's very different.
And also now, of course, if you want to audition for a drama school, it costs £50 a pop each time.
Yeah.
And if you're travelling from the north of England down to London, who's got that? If you're working class, who's got
it,
that?
Like, it was like I'd worked in the golf club, £4 an hour, and they were charging, I think it was still like £25. That was like a day, that was a whole day that I hated.
Yeah.
To go up to Central, absolutely terrified, herded in like a group where they didn't give a shit or go, thanks for coming, lovely to meet you, who are you?
Yeah.
They just sort of did some little workshop, and then after an hour went, these people can stay, the rest of you can piss off.
As a working class kid where you're not used to them, and you walk in and go,
those
I'm not meant to be here.
When I look back, I'm absolutely incandescent, really, at how they behave. Yeah. Because I think they are, the Lambda one, I just put my stuff down, wasn't supposed to say hello. I went, oh, hello, good morning. Stand in the middle of a room while they just sat there behind a desk, very grand, what are you doing? Of course, and it's not necessarily about money, it's just confidence, isn't it?
Confidence.
So that person behind the desk, one way or another, has got confidence, and you haven't. And they must have just loved seeing these like 18-year-olds come in and just look absolutely frazzled by it. They must have really got off on it. And I just think, God, you're vile. And isn't that great to say? I can say that now. Gosh, I've never
said that. You can say that now. 20 years later. There's just been a huge shake-up now, which is great, all for the better, and to stop those sort of people working in those establishments. I think most drama schools are making a real effort with that now, aren't they?
Yeah, it has to be the case. If you want any diversity of any sort in the arts, then you have to make training accessible and not make those institutions feel like completely alien and external to people's experiences. They have to represent that as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, that was another sort of experience where you go, okay,
sorry,
I don't fit here.
No,
not at all. It's so interesting. So how did you find the door, this door that was mysteriously somewhere
door
that everyone keeps telling you about? But...
Well, no one told me about comedy at all. It wasn't a thing you could do. The only bit, I loved Victoria Wood, and I sort of had an inkling that I wanted to be a bit like her, but I didn't know how you would even go about that. And I had a sense you'd have to go to all these horrible clubs and it would be really frightening.
Mm.
And I went and I joined the National Youth Theatre, which I phoned my drama teacher from school, and she said, well, have you thought about auditioning for the NYT? And it was only because she suggested it, I went for the audition, and it all just fit into place. And for a lot of people, I think they maybe didn't have that experience at that time. But for me, it just worked out. And it was a place where you could be camp. Ed Wilson was in charge. Did you do it, Laura? Did you do it, Hannah?
Do you know what? I didn't. But Hannah has.
I didn't get in. But
you direct now.
I direct for the National Youth Music Theatre.
Oh,
so
you did
I have done quite a few shows for them.
No, I've never done
it. It's a lovely thing.
NT or NYT, because I had never heard of it.
I think if someone
had told me about it, though, I would have gone and done it. Yeah.
Well, everybody would. And they've done a lot of work now, I think, to try and make people aware of it, of themselves. As far as I know. So I think that's positive. But at the time, it felt like such a rare treat, because suddenly it was like all these people were like camp and grand. They're like, that's what I want to be. I want to be like Ed Wilson. I want to be like these kind of like characters.
Found your people,
Yeah, and I did an Alan Bennett monologue, and I thought, oh, God, he's going to laugh at me doing a chip in the sugar. Chips come up, don't they, a lot for working class people?
Yeah.
But, chips on your shoulder, chips in the sugar, chips for tea.
Chips in your egg.
Chips in your egg, And then all these other people, and everybody was sort of, you know, just eccentric and different. You met all these other young people from around the country, and it still was not out, still didn't have the courage to come out, still didn't seem to meet any other gay people, or maybe met like 4 gay people out of the 1,000 other young people I met. But I just loved it, and I felt so excited, and I felt so welcome. And I'd never felt, and it really took me outside of my, you know, not, I didn't have a terrible childhood at all. I had a lovely, loving family and lots of wonderful opportunities. But it just took me outside of the small town thing that you have when you're growing up in one place.
It's amazing to walk into a room. I felt that the minute I walked in the Brit School, actually, because that's like the still one of the only non-fee paying performing arts colleges about.
Yes.
And you go there for like your A-level years. And I never forget walking in that building. And the facilities there are just incredible for what you get for free. They're way better than drama schools and people are paying for that. But I remember walking in the first time, and understandably a lot of working class kids there, because of course it's free and they can get in. And I just remember walking in and going, oh my God. Like, I just felt like, you know, that where I was putting on the posh voice and putting on the working class, it all just dissipated. And I was like, oh, I can just talk like me. And I took a while to find out who that was, actually, because I've spent so many years going in and out of different characters. Yeah, but I'll never forget that first day walking into Brit School and going, oh, wow.
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, it was really lovely.
Yeah, those moments are so powerful. And of course, for some people, drama school, I'm sure, is that. And it's unfair of me to use my experience to slag them off. And I think, like you say, Hannah, I don't think they're like that now.
So you went to NYT. Presumably you started doing funny characters, etc. Was that how you found your comedy voice? Is that
Yes, indeed. And I sort of, again, was still like acting was the thing. Stand-up was not a thing. There was only like straight blokes who did it. People like Jim Davidson. And then people like Peter Kay and Jimmy Carr were starting to come along. But they were, again, straight blokes who did blokey comedy for straight people. Like, it was all very straight.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, the acting is, you know, then I can be somebody else. But then I realised I wasn't really that, you know. NYT were brilliant to me, and I got an agent from the back of it, Evans and Rise. and they were wonderful and very encouraging to me and lovely. But I'd go for auditions. And, of course, there's no parts for young Noel Coward, Alan Bennett fans.
Well, there wasn't certainly back then, I suppose, was there?
Yeah, now I suppose we have a lot more sort of celebration of the eccentric, which is wonderful.
Mm.
And I remember going for an audition for a TV role, and they were like, oh no, too big. Why are you I didn't know the difference between theatre acting and on camera. What are you doing? No, much. Oh, God, no. This casting director, absolutely terrified. You know, that, I think I still have that sense of, oh, God, I'm too much. But then some friends of mine there, particularly Sam Battersea and Charlie Baker, they encouraged me to try stand-up because Charlie had done a bit of it, and he said, why don't you give it a whirl? And I just liked the idea of it. It felt like a dare.
Yeah, right.
So I was like, I don't belong in a place like that. I won't be able to cope. And I did it. It was sort of like, oh, how funny to think that people sort of laughed, I think, because they thought it was a funny idea that I would try it. And from that, I just sort of did it. And I did those competitions and I won them, which was lovely. But actually, they made me put more pressure on myself to be perfect, and I was rubbish. It wasn't rubbish, but I had a long journey to go on, I think, to know myself. And it meant that I'd get booked for gigs that I wasn't ready for. And I was too scared. I was just so scared all the time.
Yeah, well, it's terrifying, isn't it, going out there and trying to be funny with your own material. There's no one to blame, no text to go, well, the script is terrible, the direction was terrible. It's all on you. Yeah. It's all it's all you, and it's terrifying.
Well, I love doing stand-up because, of course, all those snooty actors I'd met when I'd gone for drama school auditions or whatever, I was suddenly like, you can't do any of this. I stand up there on my own and I've got nothing to fall back on. I've got nothing. I've got nothing else. But like, there's nothing there. There's no one there. And then I stand up and I do it. And when it worked, it was so great.
And did you start doing sort of paid gigs? Did it, like, you know, how was it to sustain that
Really. I got a few gigs, but I wasn't confident. I just didn't think I belonged there. I didn't feel like I was right. You know, I felt like I was a square peg in a round hole, but I was like, I've won these competitions. I suppose I probably should give it a whirl. And I don't seem to be able to get much work as an actor. So maybe this is the thing.
But did you enjoy it when you were up there? Did you think, oh, I'm sort of digging this?
When it went well, yes. But it would only go well about 20% of the time. So it was about 12 years of just sort of self-loathing, I suppose, and going like, it's not quite right, but I'll just do it. Or I'd just sort of deaden myself to the idea. So it didn't matter how it went. I just wouldn't think about it until I got there. I'd be too scared to write new material in case it went wrong. So I stuck to doing the same set for ages. Just terrified, just so scared all the time.
And what changed? What was the thing that made you start to think, oh, this is where I fit? Or What was the job? What was the opportunity that changed that?
I turned 30. I'd been living in like lodging with friends and stuff for a few years. And I was like, do you know what? This is starved. I want to be around my family. And that's when I moved back when I was 30. So I'd been living away for about 6 years and I moved back when I was 30. And I just was like, I've got to make a go of this now. I'm 30. What am I doing? So I used the base of my family and my home life in Bromley. And I started talking about that on stage and that sort of shifted things. So I was like, oh, stop doing that thing that they told you, you know, from drama school. Stop trying to be something you're not. Mm-hmm. Talk about being a posh sounding working class boy who's living with his mum and dad in suburban Bromley, who's gay but isn't very confident about it. Talk about all of that. That happened, and that combined with my friend Sarah Millican, who I'd done those competitions with, asked me to do a couple of support gigs for her tour, and then she booked me for loads of her support gigs, and she was such a mentor to me and really sort of broke it all down so I could just cope with it. It wasn't so overwhelming and so frightening. And I just sort of tried to learn from her and just calmly just being yourself, writing a joke, writing another joke, describing a thing, writing a punchline, you know, just sort of breaking down the craft of it. And I felt so much safer. And I really felt so kind of embedded with that. And that gave me the confidence to then, I just emailed, it was before I had the great management I have now, I just emailed 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown and said, will you consider having me on? And they went, well, come up with some ideas and come and meet us. So I did, and they had me on the show, and it was amazing. But I could only do that because I had the confidence from being with my mum and dad, my friend Sarah, and other friends as well. But it just encouraged me. And then off the back of that, I did an Edinburgh that I really enjoyed. And then I had the confidence to, well, they sort of approached me, and I had the confidence to believe they would want me, the management company, off the curb. And Flo there took me on. And that changed everything because she believed in me. And I suddenly was like, yes, maybe I am not shit. So that changed everything. So, sorry, there wasn't like a one moment where it was like, and then it was fine. And I still have that imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Of course. And, you know, it takes a village, really, doesn't it? Meeting your people where they go, I understand your voice and encourage you. That's when it all clicks into place. I was exactly the same. You know, when we were on the comedy circuit, we were sort of like being what we thought we should be.
Yes.
Actually, when I just went, you know what, fuck it, this is who I am, fuck it. That's when I started doing well. This is what I've got to offer. Yeah.
Well, my friend Rob said that to me, because you go up to Edinburgh and stuff and you feel like, again, another very middle class. I didn't enjoy Edinburgh because it was particularly in the early years of doing it. I did it for like 12 years, I think. And the early years of doing it, I was so terrified. I didn't know what I was supposed to be and what the reviewers wanted or how you get attention or what the zeitgeist was or what those bloody awards want. I felt so kind of tortured by all of it. And then was playing to like 12 people who all just stared at me. And then my friend Rob was like, just make him laugh. And that's what my friend and manager Flo said, just be fucking funny.
Yeah.
And then you just sort of go, well, that's it. Why are we getting all these other middle class essence of like, must be this, must be that. Just make people laugh. And that's what your job is. And that's what I did.
And it's amazing, you know, because you now to see you doing that in the mainstream on TV as well, you know, like when I watch you on Extra Slice, you're so brilliant. People just can't get enough of you. And that's because you can tell you're just being your authentic self. And it's so lovely to watch that. Honestly, it's so great to see your rise. My mum's been a huge fan. I wasn't lying at the beginning. She's been a huge fan for a long time. And she goes, Tom was on the telly again tonight. Very funny. Like she knows you, bless her.
Well, she does. She probably knows me better than I know myself.
So we always wrap up the show, we'll let you go in a sec, with just asking our guests if there's an unsung working class hero that they'd like to celebrate today. Who would that be for you today, Tom?
Well, there's lots of options again, of course. But I would say, I mean, there's my family. I could talk about, I'd love to talk about my nan or, you know, certainly my mum and dad. And my brother, actually, you know, like, maybe that's a good person. I mean, he worked in the city for a bit and didn't feel that was right for him and changed direction and became a tiler. He loves being a tiler. He works so hard. He's like, just, you know, and people who do jobs like that, they get often slagged off and like, oh, you know, there's no tradespeople in this country. They're all terrible. They're all bloody con men. And actually they're not. There are some bad people at it, but my brother would be the first person to sort of mention them. But, you know, he works hard. He does as good a job as he can. He tries to, the people he works with, he tries to keep them happy. He tries to keep the customers happy. He's a perfectionist. And you sort of go, well, it'd be easy to be like, oh, bloody white van mad. You know, he doesn't have a white van actually, but you don't need one for tiles. But, you know, just, I suppose him probably. or you know, my dad's various friends at the from down the golf club, which again sounds very middle class, but my dad was so proud that he'd like got into the golf club.
Yeah.
People that work hard and, you know, work long hours. Yeah, my brother's a labourer. Well, he's a painter and decorator, and he works really long hours. And like your brother, they're so proud.
Yeah.
Work, and their workmanship is just so, like, it's like second to none. And they don't earn the money that we earn when we do a little turn on telly or whatever. Sure. And I just, you know, I understand why you've picked those people, because it's, you know, and often some people, I mean, your brother loves Thailand, but some people are often getting up every day and doing a job they fucking hate.
Yeah.
But they do it, and they do it with a smile, and they carry on. And I take my hat off to those people. What's your brother's name?
James.
So we are celebrating James today, as well as you, Tom Allen.
Oh, we'll
be
pleased.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, my God. It's been such a... Sorry, I've been like... As I say, I've been surrounded by my mum and my aunt talking all the time. And I was like, well, another thing. I'll tell you another thing.
I love it.
That's exactly what
we want from this.
A silent episode would be quite boring,
wouldn't
it?
That's the thing with podcasting, isn't it? You've got to talk. But no, thank you for letting me rabbit on. Sorry. But always lovely to chat to both of you, and lovely to see you.
Thank you so much. Thanks, mate. Thank you. Well, I mean, obviously, I've fangirled completely. You know my feelings on Tom. I know you've met him a few times, but that chat was so interesting, isn't it?
I remember just being the first time I ever saw him, actually. Funnily enough, it was in a pub in Penge. So I forgot to mention that. But it's only that pub. And I remember saying to you afterwards, who is that? And you say, I mean, this was years and years ago. Mm. And you're going, I know, right? And seeing him a few times. And then when we obviously... You know, been lucky enough to meet him a few times over the years. But when you're like, oh, he comes from a very working class background, just such a brilliant guest for us to have on, isn't it? And like all those things we've always felt really passionate about like showing all the many faces of working class life and culture and connection. Yeah. It felt like such a special episode for that reason.
Yeah, and I think people that sort of, they sort of know Tom's work but might have only seen him on Bake Off or whatever.
Yeah,
go,
so
I think they'll be really surprised about his background. And you know, it's so amazing that... Well, it's silly, isn't it, to think that we'd think, oh, but he sounds really posh. How could he possibly be working class? So, yeah, I think he was a perfect guest to get on, like you said, to counteract all the things we always talk about.
Stereotypes of what it is and what it sounds like and what it looks like to be working class.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Right, well, that's it for this week, folks. We'll be back next week with a brand new guest. I am off now, Hannah, to enjoy the sun, but you're going back to work, aren't you, sadly?
Oh, dear. Thanks for rubbing that in. You enjoy yourself.
Well, at least you've got a job. Right, bye. Keep it classy.
The Proper Class podcast is produced by Michelle Farr-Scott for Rangabe Productions, edited by James Torrance, with music by Tommy Music.
Just to let you know, folks, the Proper Class podcast is now going weekly. And whilst I've got you here, please don't forget to like and subscribe. Spread the word. Tell your friends, neighbours, whoever will listen. We've also got an Instagram page. Ooh, get us. And you can follow all the news and goss at the Proper Class podcast. And if you haven't nodded off yet, we've also gone and got ourselves an official email. So do get in touch. The email is properclasspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, folks. And remember, keep it classy.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.